But you asked about a highlight of an event, and that would have to be badminton. Not necessarily, I survived the competition and my horse did very well, but Princess Diana gave me my ribbon. It was just incredible. And I do not have a photo. I can't believe it. I think she winked at, I think she winked at me too.
Welcome to the Major League Eventing Podcast, the show for eventing fans by eventing fans. Everyone knows how much we love mane and tail. And recently, our little Stanley got a rash under his neck.
Yeah, so right under his collar, he got a rash. He started scratching. It got really, really red. I got worried. Well, we got worried and we took him to the vet. So as everyone knows, we've talked about before on the show that our Sparky has bad coat and bad skin. And he's had allergies his whole life. And we've always struggled with that. And now here Stanley started with us. So we were very worried. Took him to the vet and the vet said, you know what the vet said, Karen?
She said, use mane and tail Protect.
Protect line. So here's the deal. You can use Protect every day on that hot spot, scratches,
rain rot. Ringworm.
Ringworm. So there's directions on the bottle. Get the bottle, but you can use it every day. But the key is you got to let it sit on their coat for about 10 or 15 minutes. Let it really soak in because that contact is what's going to fix this. And let it dry really well. Don't let the water fester on there. So what we have to do is we have to let Stanley's collar off and let it air out really good. We don't want any moisture, which we think is possibly him running around and creeks and swimming and all types of stuff. You know how the barn dogs are. You have a barn dog at all. So Karen, tell us a little bit more about the Protect line shampoo.
So it's a veterinary strength medicated shampoo that provides a complete cleaning and protection treatment of topical skin problems.
So it's antifungal, antibacterial, does all the above. Mm-hmm. Fantastic stuff.
And it is pH balanced and safe for daily use.
Yeah. So, and that's what I didn't realize is that we can use it every day to get this stuff cleared up. And we're using it every day. And our dogs are... It's amazing. It's night and day how fast it cleared up. So I would use it, but I would use it like once every week, and it was just wasn't enough contact. Right. So get that. And then they also have, for in-between baths, you just say you don't have time to give them a bath, topical spray. So they have a Protect line spray. It's an anti-wound spray. Same thing. You know, if your horse, your dog, your cat, who knows? But we know these barn dogs, they're out there running around, getting into water, you know, water jumps on cross country and stuff like that. So really, really fantastic stuff. So Karen, people, how do people learn more?
Just go to maneandtailequine.com.
And get it at your local tech shop, right, Karen?
Yes. And congratulations to our friend and sponsor, Trish Scott.
Yeah, she achieved her level one eventing steward. So she's an official now, Karen. So she's been working very hard on this for quite a number of years. So thank you to all our stewards and especially to our newest steward, Trish Scott.
Yeah, congratulations.
Trish Scott's got us covered and she can cover you. Trish is on with us to talk about equine mortality and medical coverages, which there's a lot of changes, Trish. So tell us what's going on in the industry right now and how can you help people?
Oh, absolutely, Rob. Thank you again for having me on. Yeah, there's a lot of changes going on in the equine mortality and medical coverage right now. And I just wanted to put the word out there that we don't have to be afraid. Changes are coming, but I can certainly take care of, you know, whatever questions, concerns, you know, our vendors have. Right now, the biggest one is Great American is not offering any medical coverage to any renewals or new business. But, and the thing is with our vendors, they're one of the top three rated horses for mortality. So it's a very unique breed of animal, very unique training. So we need to make sure that your policy is covered. I have access to some of the top rated carriers right now. They are all offering full mortality, medical, surgical, any coverage is needed for our ventures. Don't worry about it. Just give me a call. I'll be more than happy to walk through your current policy and make sure that your renewal is covering your horse. Not a problem. Just give me a call. I'm always available. 484-319-8923.
Triple Crown Feed.
Oh, Karen. Yeah.
Triple Crown. Big fans of Triple Crown Feed. They have tons of great products out there. Mm-hmm. Premium stuff. Karen, what do you got to say over there?
So Triple Crown has formulas that are tailored to your horse's unique needs and help support immunity and gut health. Find your local Triple Crown Feed dealer by going to triplecrownfeed.com.
TripleCrownFeed.com. That's a little bit of a tongue twister. TripleCrownFeed.com. They have a great feed locator. They have a great feed comparison tool on their website. I encourage everyone to get over there, check out Triple Crown Feed's website, check out the different products, check out what makes them so special, and give them a shot, right, Karen?
Oh, yeah.
Support the people to support the show. The Rain Turtle by Turtleneck, the best rain sheet on the market, Karen.
The best. It comes in a 1, 2, and a 3-piece with a 3-year waterproof warranty. And it has a full antibacterial lining.
Yeah, fantastic. Of course, they have the stretch panels. So, Karen, if people want to learn more, learn about the Rain Turtle, the sizing, how to measure your horse for sizing, how do people learn more and purchase the Rain Turtle by Turtleneck?
Just go to turtleneck.biz.
Fairfax and Favor is even good for guys like me, Karen, who are shopping. So what's really cool is they have color collections. So they have matching handbags and accessories that go with shoes, all different types of shoes. So for a guy like me who's shopping, it's very simple for me to match up what you have. So your birthday's coming up soon. Just kind of curious if there is some favorite color that you like.
I'm obsessed with their mango and cornflower collection right now.
Cornflower.
Yes, perfect for the summer season.
Yeah, so mangoes kind of looks like a mango color. Mm-hmm. Cornflower is like a baby blue.
Yes.
Super, super cute. And they come with, they have shoes and accessories in all these different colors. So it's very easy to match. And you know, for a guy like me who's not very good at that.
Right. And they also have the trainer with the mango and cornflower stripes.
Yeah, well, that's very cool. So that way, just think about it. You get the trainer with the two different color stripes and then...
Oh, two different purses.
Exactly. Ooh, so
a mango purse and a cornflower
I'm
purse.
Getting myself in trouble over here.
You sure are.
So Karen, if people want to check mango and cornflower out for themselves and other great Fairfax and Favor products, where do they go?
All they have to do is go to fairfaxandfavor.com.
Let's do it.
Let's do it. All right. Ready?
Yep.
I'm Karen.
And I'm Rob. Karen. I say it all the time that I'm very excited.
I know.
And I am excited. I love all of our guests. However, we have celebrities on and then we have big time celebrities, yes. Karen. So today we have a gentleman who's been there, done that. I'm going to say just a few things.
Jack of all trades.
Jack of all
trades. Right?
And he's a master of them all. Two-time World Games competitor, Pan Am bronze and silver medalist. He's competed at badminton, Burley, Boca, Lumen in Kentucky. He's also a Grand Prix dressage rider, mm-hmm. and he's going to be a judge at the World Games, Karen.
Yeah.
So welcome to the show, Peter Gray.
Welcome.
Thank you, Rob and Karen. I'm delighted to be here. And by the way, I love the name Major League Eventing. That is so cool. And I have been listening to your podcast and I love them. You've got a great inventory of interesting things. So thank you for the show.
Aw, thank you.
So good. We got to thank our friends over at Ride IQ.
Yes, Peter's Jessa also, and Kinsey.
Yep, Jess and Kinsey. Peter's also a coach on Ride IQ. So, you know, if you can't get to one of his clinics or in person training with him, you can always listen to Ride IQ. So thank mm-hmm. you to those ladies and those great people for bringing helping make this connection to Peter. So I'm so excited.
Yeah,
I'm so excited. So without further ado, Karen, let's get this thing going. We have too much to talk about to listen to me. So you're coming to us by Zoom. We always like to just find out you're traveling all the time. Where are you coming to us from right now? Just so people get an idea of where you're at.
Right now, I'm in Orangeville, Ontario, Canada, which is about 1 hour from Toronto. And I summer here, and I winter in Ocala, Florida. It's beautiful up here, but the summers are short, so I usually head south around the 15th of October.
Ooh. Oh, see, that sounds... I think that sounds pretty awesome. Dude, Canada and in Ocala, I think you got the best of both worlds. So
yeah.
That is fantastic. All right. So, Karen Annie...
Yeah, let's get started.
Let's get started.
So, Peter, we always love to go back and hear your origin story. So can you take us back and tell us how you got your start in riding?
Oh, my gosh. Okay, well, I grew up as a kid in the Commonwealth of Bermuda, and I was sixth generation Bermuda citizen, and it was an absolutely stunning place to grow up. I just had the greatest childhood there. I didn't have horses around me, but the few horses that we have on the island, mostly carriage horses, and there's a pony club there and a riding club. But I remember as a small kid going down to the road and hiding behind the tree just to wait for the carriage horses to come by and just watch them go by in awe. And I just wanted to ride. My father was an Olympic sailor, and he was like most disappointed that I was going on this tangent, but I really just couldn't get it out of my system. So yeah, I started in Bermuda as a kid.
Wow.
Oh my goodness.
Now, so your pony club, you joined the pony club, and that's how you kind of learned to ride?
Yeah, I joined the pony club there, but before then, our family didn't really have the means to pay for riding lessons, so I cycled up to the riding stable and asked if I could work there for my lessons, and I did that for 2 years, I think, and then I was offered a gift as a horse. And so that was my first horse. His name was Bill.
Oh. And
I didn't realize at the time that a 25-year-old gelding they cribbed wasn't what everyone was looking for. But they found a sucker to take this horse. Bill was, I think, 25. I had him for about 15 years. That poor thing went to every horse show. We were champion at every horse show. We never won higher than like a sixth place ribbon, but we entered every single class. So he was always high point, but gave me a good start. And with that, I joined the Pony Club.
Wow, so. Bill. Now,
Bill.
And Pony Club, Bermuda, I've never been, but I would like to go. Is there enough pony clubs there to actually have rallies? And
There's only one pony club, but we still have a rally amongst ourselves, which is great fun. But honestly, we had great instructors. They were mostly from the United Kingdom. They were British Horse Society certified ladies that came out to teach at the local riding school. And with a couple of local ladies, they formed the pony club. And honestly, the education was fantastic. We had the best fun and I learned so much. And I took my pony club exams up to B level there. And then when I did post-secondary school in England, I did my pony club A there. Actually, I did it twice. I didn't get it the first time. I really enjoyed the pony club. And actually, to this day, I still support the pony club and do anything I can in the way of discounted lessons or clinics.
Wow.
Oh, that's nice.
That's amazing. Pony club is fantastic. So can you, okay. So I don't want to, there's so much to talk about, but I really like to know, your beginning is so humble. I think that's, I don't want to gloss over it because it's really cool. And the fact that where you're at today and everything you've accomplished was such a humble beginning. I just think it's, I don't want to gloss over it because I think that's inspiring to the person that's listening that feels that they're so far away from achieving this goal. So you went to school. Can you take us through from leaving Bermuda to go in the UK, like the whys, and then how you ended up back in Canada?
Yeah. So, you know, you raised a point, which I'll just go back to my early days in Bermuda. I had about three major teachers over a 4-year period when I was learning to ride. And each of them said, Peter, you're never going to be a rider. Take up basketball. I'm 6'4" now. And I think when I was 13, I was 6'4", very uncoordinated. I can't remember a lot of what I did when I was 14 or 13 or 14, 15, but I remember very clearly trying to learn to post the trot. I was hopeless. So I think the story is right from those days when I watched the carriage horses going by, for whatever reason, I wanted to ride in the Olympics. And every time one of these teachers told me to take up basketball, it just killed me inside. And deep down, I knew I could make it and I really wanted to make it. And the dream came true.
Wow. So I love that. Don't give up.
I know. Never give power up.
Power of positive thought.
Yes. Do you feel a little bit of... Was it a little bit of a motivational fuel? Like, I know obviously it was motivational fuel, but are you the type of personality that says, you know what, where's that riding instructor now? And did they see me when I was riding into Pan Ams and getting my medal on the podium, or when I was riding at the Worlds? Or was that a little bit of a motivator too, to kind of stick it to these coaches who said you would never?
No, I don't know. One thing, a weakness or a strength, I'm not sure what it is, but I never hold a grudge against people and I don't think backwards. I just look ahead and try to surround myself with positive thoughts and positive people.
Wow. Yeah, does that make awesome. You somewhat empathetic to your words and what they carry when you're talking to a person?
Yes. Yes, especially when I'm judging. And I think, I sometimes wonder how I got this position to be at the World Championships, because there's many great judges in the world. But like you said, I'm a jack of all trades. I actually tick a lot of boxes. I was a writer. I was a coach, event organizer, lots of committees, good communication skills. Now competing at FEI levels in dressage. And so that, I think, keeps me humble, the fact that I'm still going in there doing it myself as I'm critiquing other people. And Sarah Kosnick, like, had a great dressage series of schooling shows this winter in Ocala. And I signed up for a couple of them. And the one in April, they were doing the test for Kentucky, the 5-star B. And I thought, well, I'll take my fancy dressage horse and do the 5-star B. Well, it wasn't so easy as I thought. And so when I'm judging and I think, okay, I know that extended canter and then collected canter and then immediately go into a stretch circle is quite difficult. So I'm going to be not lenient, but I'm going to be more understanding.
Wow. Yeah, and this is going really in cool. with a Grand Prix horse of yours?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, he's actually, this one I have is Prix St. George I-1. He's not quite a Grand Prix, but yeah.
I love that so much.
Yeah, I do too. Yeah,
I love that. You know that. Hey, wow. So you writing it yourself is saying, oh, it's a little harder than on the paper. I get it. And of course, you're judging per the movement, so you're going to be even across the board. But I love the fact that you have that. You've done the test
in the back of your mind.
Yeah, but what's really interesting is, now when I'm teaching someone to prepare for their dressage test, I will say to them, this is how we've always been taught to do this. I know this is, in your mind, the correct way to do it. But I can tell you as a judge, if you do it this way, I'm going to give you more marks. And at the end of the day, that's what it's all about. At the top, the competition is so, so tight. Just one point here or there. You know, you miss a rein back or a flying change or something can make a difference on the podium.
Do you still ride with a dressage judge? Do you still have a coach or do you still have a coach of your own?
Yes, yes. She's a 7-time Olympian for Canada, Christelle Boylan. Absolutely brilliant trainer and rider. And so I've been very lucky to be with her for the last 5 years.
That's so cool. I love this. It's like you do it all and you still get coaching. It's like, we're never too big for coaching. No. You know? Every once in a while, like, it just seems like the bigger the person, the more they're willing to share that they get coached. Mm-hmm. And it seems like the big fish, little pond people are like, they think they know it all.
So. Oh, yeah. I watch lots of videos and educational seminars and podcasts, and you just can't stop learning. And I think from a judge's point of view, to this day, I have a couple of mentors that I think were very influential in making me hopefully a successful judge. Marilyn Payne being one, Linda Zhang being one. And to this day, I'll phone them up and say, hey, look, this happened in the ring. I gave this first score. Do you think I was on track? Because Karen and Rob, you wouldn't believe what can happen in the ring, that things that you've never seen before, you never taught about how to judge, what to do if this happens. So you have to use common sense. You have to use your experience. But it's nice to have a sounding board after the fact to check up with your mentors and say, was I on track? So I still do that.
Yeah, that's awesome.
That's wonderful that our judges are talking to each other and stuff. And even as a judge, you might see something that you've never seen before.
So I was just going to say one point on that subject. I was judging the 4-star this year at Land Rover, but I watched the 5-star, and Micah Young had a fantastic test. It was not only a great example for his fellow competitors to watch, but actually a great example for judges to watch because he showed all the things that we're supposed to be looking for technically. But one of the things that I phoned another mentor about, situation that happened in there, did a beautiful halt, must have been a 10. then the rein back to canter is one mark. And just the rein back was perfect. It was uphill, it was willing, it was diagonal pairs. And he just walked a step forward and went beautifully into the canter. So I'm thinking another nine. However, just before he stepped back, he did a half a step forward before going back. I'm like, geez, I'm not judging this, but I'm thinking that was probably a six. But in fact, no. If you're on a nine, you might come down one mark. Not much. You're always learning.
Wow. I love it. See, now... YouTube is going to go crazy with people watching that.
Yeah, I know. I want to watch it now.
They're going to go back, watch it, and say, okay, here we are. And I love the fact that you're always studying. You know, you're always studying and always learning. And that's why this is so great that you're going to be judging at the Worlds, because I think that that's what you need is people who are passionate about getting it right.
And exactly. Getting it right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
But it's not an inexpensive sport. And the effort people go to get to that level and the expense, you have to be on at 8 in the morning and still on giving 100% at 5 in the evening. And that takes a lot of focus to give, but you have to give that to them. You owe it to them to be the best judging you can.
Yeah. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So there's so much to cover. I want to kind of jump just a little bit.
Go right ahead.
But as far as your riding career goes, we listed some of these many events that you've competed at and done. As a event rider, could you share with us like what was a highlight of your career? Like what was your favorite event or most memorable event?
Well, I think the highlight part was, to pick up where I left off, I went to England to finish my studies. And while I was there, I got hooked on eventing. They had a natural history society in the school I was at. And every Wednesday there was a coach trip off to Stonehenge or Westminster Abbey or something. And then there was the Tidworth horse trials. And it would take normally about 3 or 4 days for the 48 seats on the coach to get filled up. But this Tidworth horse trials thing, within about 20 minutes, every spot was taken on the first day. And I'm like, man, eventing's really popular in this school. So I got a spot on the bus. So off we went to the horse trials. Interestingly enough, I didn't see a single one of my schoolmates there. I didn't know where they went until going back to the bus. I went past the beer tent, and there they all were. But they weren't at all interested in eventing. But that's where I got hooked. I just thought it was the greatest sport, and I still think so. It's just wonderful.
Oh, man, that's fantastic.
So that was going to their school. Then I came back Then I came to Canada to do a science degree. And when I started competing internationally, it seemed that it would be the right thing for my own experience to go to Europe and train amongst the best. So I went for 2 years in the late 80s and early 90s. And then I went back for another 2 years in the late 90s. So that would be the highlight, not a particular event, although there is one event that comes to mind, but just the experience of going to Europe. At that time, there was no Brexit, so it's very easy just to put your horse on the ferry, go to Le Moulin, go to Buccalo, go to Lyon Tanger, go to anywhere you wanted. It was so easy, and the mileage I got and the experience of going to all these fantastic competitions and riding alongside the best in the world, that for me was the highlight of my entire career and the biggest learning curve.
Wow. Again, it goes back to the learning. Like you're just a sponge, you know, you just love to learn. That's so cool.
But you asked about a highlight of an event, and that would have to be badminton. Not necessarily I survived the competition and my horse did very well, but Princess Diana gave me my ribbon. It was just incredible. And I do not have a photo. I can't believe it.
Wow.
I think she winked at me too.
Oh, there you go.
Listen, I would have been a little starstruck a little bit.
Yeah, definitely.
What a looker.
I mean, I get starstruck when I see Zara, you know, and she's that Princess Di.
Yeah, that's incredible. Man, oh man, that is so cool. That's the fun stuff about Britain is that the royal family is so involved in the eventing and all.
They're so involved. It's amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That is really cool. Wow. I love that.
Yeah, that is really cool.
At what point in time do you think it started clicking for you? Like you said, it took so long to learn how to post your trot and all that. But when did you start to say, okay, I can do this?
Never.
You eventually learn how to post your trot.
Honestly, I didn't have big sponsors, so I produced. I think maybe I had a good eye for horses, so I would go to Ireland and England and buy 2 horses a year, maybe, and produce them and sell most of them, but keep one that I could compete at an upper level. But I only ever had one at a time. I never had a string. I never had a sponsor. So I remember one competition in the US, I was competing advanced and feeling rusty on my one horse. And Philip had 8 horses going in that advanced division. And I realized that in one day, he got as many miles cross country as I did in 1 year. Because you do about 8 advanced competitions in a year. In one day, he would do the same number of rides. And that's very difficult to keep up with those guys when you've got one horse. But you know what? They gave me a lot of success. They gave me a lot of experiences. They all competed until they were in their mid-teens, late teens. They were sound. I looked after them. I perhaps wasn't as competitive as I could have been because it was too wet or too cold or too hard. I would look after my horse. But they lasted a long time and had a lot of success.
Wow. Again, more inspiration of people that they're one horse at a time person. Yeah. And then, which is, you know, we're that type of family, you know, like our son has one horse at a time and he's had his own struggles and both of our sons. And, you know, when you have that one horse, the one horse pulls a shoe, that one horse gets an abscess, that one horse pulls up just ever so slightly off, you know, that's it. That's what you have, you know, and it's tough to swallow and then see the events still tick off and other people that have multiple horses that get to go.
Yeah. I do have to mention one thing. When I went to Canada, I met a family in Ontario and I got introduced into the eventing in North America. And at the time, he was trying out for the Canadian team, and I actually ended up buying his horse as my first international horse. But we were at the same age, the same stage at university, and we became very good friends. And his trainer was General Michael Katovsky, who fled the war, touring Europe after World War II. He was from Poland. He was in the cavalry. He show jumped in the 32 Olympics and fled Europe and came to Canada and became the show jumping coach. And his first working student was a very famous Canadian show jumping rider, Captain Canada, Ian Miller. And some of the top dressage riders started with General Katovsky. But through my friend, I was able to, Dick Meredith, I was able to get in with General Katovsky. And honestly, I rode with him maybe 23 years. This man was unbelievable. He taught me pretty much everything I know about training horses. And he had a very passive approach to riding. The horse was never wrong. It was always the rider. He was very sympathetic. He wouldn't deal with a lot of pressure with the horse, on the horse, or he was just such a great mentor. And I didn't have any money in those days, and he didn't charge me. And I, you know, 23 years, I never paid for a lesson. But he told me something very valuable, and that was when we're talking about the longevity of my horses. He said, "Peter, it's better to upgrade a year too late than one day too early, because eventing is all about confidence and partnership. And we see it all the time. Kids trying to get to young riders or trying to get to Land Rover, and they're really 6 months, 12 months away from being there, but they see the big stars, and they just want to maybe push the horses a little too much, and then you got to backtrack a year or two when things go wrong and they lose confidence. So yeah, better to upgrade a year too late than a day too early. And I've used that with all my students, all my horses, and it's paid off not only training-wise, their mental happiness, and their soundness.
Yeah. Well, and I think, yeah, like you see young event horses, and they come up, and now you have people running intermediate and advanced with 8, 9, 10-year-olds, and you think, I got to catch up. I got to keep up. Like, this is the track I need to be on. And yeah. But then you see someone like, you know, Boyden, like On Cue, that wonderful mare. I mean, she did not get to the advanced level until late. You know, her kind of advanced career has kind of been shortened because there was time taken to get her up there. So are you aware, like, do you have thoughts on that? Like, do you think that's a push to get some of these young event horses up there? Or?
I think that sometimes people push them too quickly. You know, when going preliminary at 6 years old, for me, that's a little bit of a rush. You know, they've got their whole life ahead of them. My horses, when they were 14, 15, 16, 17 year old, that's when they were a joy to ride. You just literally put them in cruise control. You had a partnership. You're like an old married couple. But people don't get to that stage. They break them in the meantime. Yeah. But On Cue, going back to On Cue, she's older. It didn't do her any harm having babies and doing the things she did before she started eventing. And she's a fabulous eventer.
Yeah,
she sure is.
Oh, man. He's got his Maryland 5-star shirt on.
I noticed that.
That's our backyard. We live 10 minutes from there, and we love that event.
Okay, there we go.
There you go.
It was meant to be, Karen.
There we go.
So now, and you coached in, I hate to jump, but there's just so much we could talk about, but I don't want to keep Peter on forever.
We'd be here all day.
We could be here all day, and I could listen to you all day, but I don't want to, I don't want to ruin your night. Then you coached Canada. Can you take us through like how you went from riding to coaching? And I know you continued to ride and even go back and compete for the team. Can you take us through that little part of your career?
Yeah, that's the fun thing about eventing. There doesn't seem to be an age limit. Your technical skills just keep improving. I do think when you get older, if you don't have a string of horses, you always feel a little bit anxious, a little bit rusty because you've got your one. I think before Karen O'Connor retired, I think she was riding the best she ever did. She had a lovely string. She was just right on the ball. It's a great sport for that reason. But so I had quite a lot of international exposure as a competitor. And then in 1996, I became a Canadian citizen. And there was an application for coaching the Canadian team. And I didn't have a horse at that time. So I applied and got that job. So I coached the team until 2000. So 96 was the Atlanta Olympics, but as well as our high performance squad. In those days, the coach also did what we called athlete development. We went around the country and taught what now is being taught by Leslie Law, the under 25 group, the under 21 group. So the same coach, the senior coach, did those as well. We had days for coaches to teach them how to be better educators for their students. So it was a great time in Canada, and I really, really enjoyed it. We had great management, great committees, very enthusiastic and knowledgeable people. So it was a good time for me in Canada.
Are you a part of like kind of the current Canadian, high performance at all? Like, were you helping like revamp that, or were you involved?
No, I've been involved for probably 20 years with the committee in one way or the other with high performance. But I think change is good to get new blood to get new ideas. And so, yes, I'm not involved at the current time.
Gotcha. So moving on again, I don't want to, I hope maybe we can get you on again someday. We can get a deeper dive into some things.
Yeah.
But cause I could literally go year by year type of thing. But no, I know. I don't want to do that. As far as your now your WEG opportunity coming up here, could you take us a little bit through that? For you, what is the preparation as a judge for the WEG? Like, can you take us through a little bit of your schedule, your timeline, or do you just show up just like any other event, or do the judges have some pre-work they have to do? And take us through your thoughts on this.
Yeah, well, first of all, comes the selection to be a judge, which was, of course, maybe this would be my second highlight of my lifetime after getting my badminton ribbon from Princess Diana. But to get called up to judge at the WEGs, I mean, was just, I couldn't believe it. There's lots of great judges they could have chosen, but I think you need to have a certain skill level. You have to have proven at a certain number of competitions. And I think be a team player. That's probably the biggest thing, to be a team player, to be approachable and to be rider friendly. So as far as the actual preparation for the games goes, it's, I think, a number of opportunities have come up where you can judge with the team that you're going to be with at the games. So you know each other a little bit. You've worked together a little bit. You know your personalities. And it's nice to get that out of the way before you go there. To go there on a clean slate and not know the people, I think, is not such a great idea. So my two colleagues there are Christina Klingspor, Kiki, and Christian Steiner. I haven't actually judged with Christian, but he was doing the 5-star Land Rover and I was doing the 4. So we hung out a lot. We had some discussions about movements and I hung out with that ground jury a little bit so we could exchange ideas and I could network a bit with Christian. But the FAI does offer opportunities for us to work together before WEG, not only to meet each other, but actually to judge together. So this year I've been with Kiki at Stapleview and Carolina, and we're going to be doing Great Meadows together and Bromont, the Nations Cup at Bromont. There is a new rule this year that the whole team of judges, all three of you, cannot judge together. Because I think they feel that everyone's going to go to those competitions because the World Championship judges are there and they want to get exposed to those judges. So in fairness to competing competitions around the world, they don't allow the team of three judges to appear together. We did Aachen 3 weeks ago, which was a huge thrill for me. And Kiki was head of the grand jury there, so I judged with her.
Wow. See, that's, I love the insight of finding out what's going on behind the scenes.
And I never thought about that either. That
makes a lot of sense. You know, you hear of, obviously, getting exposure to the judges. Is that, how can I put this? I've heard that, you know, it's good to get on the international stage and be exposed to these judges and then, do you find that that's like true that some of these, like when you're competing at that high level, that a judge who's never seen you before might be a little more critical or is that, do you find that to be possibly true? Yeah. I've heard of people going to Europe just for the fact to get in front of some European judges. So when they get to a world-class, a worldwide international event, they've been seen before and they're known and there's some rapport maybe.
Yeah. I think honestly in the world of pure dressage, that is very much the situation. But for some reason in eventing, it's a different story. I honestly believe we are very, very good. And there's lots of things I don't do well, but I think one of the things I do is I judge every performance in the ring. I'm hoping this is going to be the winning ride. I judge what I see. We are taught not to have prejudice if it was an ex-wife and she was a cow during the divorce, or if you had a bad horse sale with the person you're judging. You know, so many interactions you can have with people that might not be positive, and here you are judging them. You have to judge what you see and put all of that behind you. And I think the eventing judges are very, very good at that. And I know I don't have a problem at all. Ad hoc and the two other judges had Ingrid Klimke on Hale Bob in first place, and I had him on fifth. So at the lunch break, I got some stern looks from the German team, and I kept walking. But I'm not prejudiced by the fact that he got a 20 from the judges 4 weeks prior. I judge what I see, and it was where I put him.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
That's good to know.
So I think that really we have a great group of judges in eventing, and they are fair, and they really want to do their best for the riders.
Yeah. Well, I think that's fantastic, especially with you know, people like yourself on there that have that mentality. And I think that if there ever was that, the culture can change as you get on new, and they're doing a good job of selecting good judges that have that mentality. So that's fantastic to hear. Along the lines of judging, if it's okay, could I ask you can I just pick your brain as a judge, a couple of things. Like, I hear the term, like, for something an everyday rider is listening to, like, can you talk about, like, you hear the term ring craft, and as a judge, what does that matter? What are you, if it does, what do you look for? What could be something that someone can do, or what is part of ring craft that sets someone apart when they come in, and can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah. Rob, as we get into that subject, I will give another shout out to Ride IQ. It's if you don't have it, it's a phone app. They've got a library of great audio lessons. And I did a review of the 23 of the new dressage tests for this year. And we talk a little bit about ring craft, or what I refer to ringmanship. And sometimes when I'm judging, I will put for the rider mark, you know, great ringmanship. So what does that mean? I think what it means, it's so interesting, the things that have evolved in my brain as a judge and as a trainer, and how to get the best marks, how to train people to get the best marks. But what you do at home in your dressage training, and what you do in the warm-up, is like a different sport when you go in the ring. When you go in the ring, it's ringmanship, it's ring craft. It's a happy horse, it's a happy look, it's soft, it's fluid, smooth transitions, good geometry. And ring craft or ringmanship would be the ability to make everything look easy, to make all the transitions seamless. And some people can do it, and some people just can't do it, and some people have been taught incorrectly. For example, at a low level, training level, B turn right, E turn left in trot. You know, we see that all the time in the lower level tests. I see people trotting along, slowing down as they get to B and making a 90 degree turn, and then building the trot and then slowing down when they get to E to make a 90 degree turn. Someone with good ringmanship would ride it like 2/4 of a circle, so almost like an S, and round it off. And to the judge, the appearance is fluency. It's like someone skating on ice. There's no change in the tempo. There's no rigidity in the horse's body because you're making these tight turns. So I see a lot of micromanaging of horses and riders, micromanaging the walk and the trot and the canter, trying to make it perfect. No, that's what you've done in the warm-up. That's what you've done in training at home. You've taught them to balance from the rein, to go forward from the leg. But when you go in the ring, the training ends. I see too many people training in the ring. It's like a different part of the sport. You've got to go in and do something that's totally different from everyday riding. It is totally different from everyday riding. So this is what, as a judge, I love to teach the rider tests. I love to teach, I mean, obviously, I teach jumping, I teach grid work, I'm fanatical on position and equitation and rhythm and balance. But when it comes to the dressage, to get the engagement, to get the quality of the walk and the trot and the canter. But then I love the ring craft. I love teaching that because it's something that people do poorly.
Wow. How about that? Does the
you going to sign up for a lesson, Rob?
You know what? I wish
you seem,
I could
you ride. Seem fascinated.
I am fascinated. Yeah. And, I wish I could ride. I don't ride. I've rode as a kid, just backyard kind of trail ride stuff, but I never was formally trained at all. And I wish I did. And maybe someday.
You never know.
Maybe someday. But I am so fascinated. Like I'm a learner. Like I'm an information junkie. And so that's just me. I'm truly fascinated by the process. Does it matter to you as someone enters the arena before they go in the actual dressage the ring, as they're going around in a circle, does that have any influence on you? I know you're still usually, you know, finalizing the prior scores, but does that help when the person comes in and says, hello, is there, do things like that even put you in a better mood when someone comes in a different way? Or is that part of ring craft too, or not?
It definitely is.
Oh, it is.
It definitely is. A lot of time I've got my head down. I'm cussing Rick Dungerton for not giving us more time in between rides, but, at the upper levels at FEI, there is a nice little break where I think it's really important for me anyway. I don't know about other judges, but I need to reprogram myself. Just get kind of in a zen, ready for the next ride and put what I've seen behind me. Take a deep breath and get ready for the next one, which hopefully will be the winning ride. But with that extra time, you do get a chance to watch them go around the ring. And as a trainer, I'm always interested what people do when they go around the ring. So now I teach my students, when you go on the round around the ring, show the judge what you can do, not what you can't do, which sounds very obvious, but if you've got a 4-beat canter, don't do that going around the ring. You know, at least you can get 50% away 50% through the test without cantering and get some good marks from the judge until he's disappointed when he sees the canter. But if he already knows that damn canter is coming up, he's going to be maybe just a little reserved to give you the trot marks. Same with, you know, I judged a horse recently with quite a poor rhythm in the walk. It was lateral. And as she was waiting for the whistle to go, she was walking and walking and walking. I'm like, oh my God, when she walks, I'm gonna have to give that a 5. And you are not supposed to prejudge. You're not supposed to, but you know, when you're sitting there looking, you can't help it. But show the judges what you can do, not what you can't do. And I think that is a time going around the ring that people need to learn also to do a better job, to get in the zone as a rider, to prepare your horse in the final 5 minutes before you go into the competition arena, that the horse is prepared mentally and that two of you are one and you are feeling relaxed and ready to really kill it. When you go around the ring, I never forget in Bromont many years ago, it's kind of an electric ring because it's down, and whenever you have crowds that are built up around you, like a coliseum, it can be a bit daunting for the horses. And sometimes we see tension in the dressage when we have spectators up high. And I never forget, David O'Connor went in front of me and I was just watching, and his horse went in the ring and really got quite tense. And I learned a great lesson that day, which I still teach my students. Whatever it takes to get the horse to perform that center line to his very best ability, that's what you do going around the ring. David went rising trot, stretched in a low frame. How many people do you see that going around the ring before they rising trot, stretch him in a low frame? But it was the best preparation he could do for that horse that was tight in his hindquarters and tight in his back and a bit anxious in his mind. Rising trot, patting his neck, use your voice, do a circle or two, pick up canter, away you go, and he got over it. So that was really skillful training, not riding, but training in my mind, horsemanship. And people need to pay attention to the good riders. What do they do when they go around the ring? Or what do they don't do? They don't go near that cluster of cameramen and spook the horse. They stay away from the cameramen. There's so many things you can learn watching the ring craft of the top riders. And my gosh, that 2 minutes around the ring, that's so influential for that entrance. You got to get it right. You have to prepare your horse the best possible way you can. So you have to have a few tricks up your sleeve, and you have to be prepared for the unexpected, like spooking at that camera, or the roof falls off the judge's box as you're going by it or something. And stay calm, stay cool, try to regain the confidence of your horse, and still trying to get that winning score.
As someone, and last question about this type of thing. Well, then I have one or two more. But like when someone's coming down center line, do you want like eye contact and a big smile, or does that matter to you? Is it all about just whatever it takes for that rider? If they're looking above your head, or you know,
That is such an interesting question. Part of the program, part of the pathway for judges, the FEI has a great. Global exchange for judges, where they try to give you an opportunity to judge, like for North Americans to judge in Europe, for Europeans to come to America. They try to offer that opportunity to help judges advance with their experience. So I very luckily received the grant twice. And my first time going to England, I did Burnham Market. So I had it was the final run for badminton. So I had all the top horses and riders there. It was such a thrill to judge them. But this eye contact, it was something I've never experienced before. You know, I've been trained and I tell my riders to look the judge in the eye and be positive and make it look like you're relaxed and having a great time. But I had an experience over there. It's almost like an intimidation stare down as they come past you. They stare at you. They look at you. They turn. They're still looking at you. Like, have you given me that 10 yet? Have you written down that 10 yet?
I'm watching.
And it's found that interesting. And you brought it up. Going around the ring before they start. The beautiful girls from Poland, you know, they stop and they curtsy and they introduce themselves and their name and their horse's name and give you a little curtsy, and away they go. I'm like, oh man, then the girls and some of the military guys, I mean, whatever it takes, they wink at you, they're like, wow, these guys are professionals. These are professional athletes. They know how to squeeze every mark out of every phase of the competition, starting with the dressage judge.
So a little flirting goes a long way.
It seemed to work, yeah.
I love it. That's funny.
That's fantastic. Well, see, and you know, because I don't ride, I think I feel like I can ask questions that are because I don't have anything to gain personally. I don't ride. I don't coach people. I'm just curious. I'm just a curious person. So, you know, maybe that's something someone else that rides or is another professional may not want to ask a judge because maybe it feels funny. So, pet peeves, but before we kind of get off the judging thing, are there pet peeves as a judge, or at least with you, if you're their judge, don't do this?
Yeah, there are.
Are you looking at like boots? The boots need a high buff, or are you okay with just a regular? Like, are you that detailed, or are you?
I'm pretty okay with color, with bling, with sparkles, with braids. I really like snaffles. I don't like strong bits. I really don't like harsh hands. I like soft, sympathetic hands. And as far as the movements go, one of my biggest pet peeves is in one of the four-star tests is a shoulder in down the long side, and then at P you do a half circle. So you're finishing the shoulder in and you just blend into the half circle. This is that ring craft we were talking about, making everything smooth like you're just gliding on ice. So people do the shoulder in, they straighten for two steps, and then they go back to the bend that the head and the shoulder in and start their circle. It should all be one. People that slow down to go deep in the corner makes me crazy, because when we're judging movements, the first mark that comes to mind is the quality of that canter. And then if you're doing a canter half pass, you look at the technical components of the movement and just say that canter was a 7 if the positioning of that half pass and the bend was correct. You might go up to a 7.5. If the horse maintains an uphill balance and the connection is good and the head is still and he's really super engaged, you might go up to an 8. But that 7 canter, if the haunches are leading, you might drop it down to a 6. And then if the head becomes unstable, you might go down to a 5.5. So you're going up and down from this gait score. So what I see, one of my big pet peeves is in trot or canter when people actually, so here's me, I want to judge that fluid forward trot, that these seamless transitions that I refer to, and people slow down to go deep in the corner. Now we've all been taught, go deep in the corner, go deep in the corner. Don't go deep in the corner. And if you watch the top riders, and let's pick the winner of Kentucky, he has a lovely balance of going deep enough into the corner, but not going so deep that he has to slow down. He loses the tempo. He goes not so deep that he doesn't bend his horse, so he'll round off that turn a little bit and have a little bit of banana bend through his horse's body through every corner in the dressage ring. And then we see people slowing down and going deep in the corner. The head comes up. They're not supple. The tempo slows down. It's so easy. They just need to be taught how to ride in the ring.
Wow. There you go.
But those are my two that come to mind. I'm sure there's other things not referring to actual movements. Maybe I'll think of them as we go along.
you can always say, oh, by the way, and I really hate this when someone does this, by the way. Oh, man. So
good stuff.
It is fantastic mm-hmm. stuff. As far as you mentioned a lot about training and your students and all, let's talk about your current business and what you currently do. You know, so what do you do? What is your professional career made up of? Is it mostly training, coaching, and then traveling for shows? Yeah, what type of coaching do you do?
The business model has changed over the years. First of all, I have an amazing husband who was a partner of mine in this business for many years. He came to Canada when he was 16 to buy a horse from me with his coach, Denny Emerson. And 35 years later, we're still together, and we've been a great team. He's been great for my business, and he's been sort of the behind-the-scenes finance, schedule, organizer, planner, really integral part of anyone's team. So we went from many years of working students, training young kids, training young horses, horses in training, riders in training. And we had masses of people just all over our house and everywhere we went. It was a great time. They worked really, really hard, but they rode hard. They got training every day, and we produced some great riders that went on to be successful. And we trained young horses as a part of something to generate income. Back in the day, myself and Peter Green were pretty much the only people actually selling horses. We imported them from Europe. And I had a very good reputation because I was honest with what I was presenting to the potential customer. And maybe lucky that between Paul and I, he has a better eye for a horse than I do, but we picked some nice prospects and we created a nice business. That then changed into doing more training and less working students, although we then went on to having one or two working students who were really, I like to call them more apprentices, because they were learning the trade, learning the business of how I like to train horses. The farm got sold in Ocala. We were there at a nice spot for 20 years, just before COVID. And now it's shifted. We have a house with no business there. So I do masses and masses of teaching in the wintertime in Florida, but not really training horses. I don't have a stable now. I have my own competition horses. Paul has his. We just have three between the two of us. So the riding is just our own horses, and we compete them. And I do masses of teaching. And it's sort of like when I came out of university, I got in my car and drove around and taught, and that's what I'm doing now. But I use different facilities in Ocala and try and group the lessons in half a day, have everyone come to that that spot. So it has changed a bit. I love change, so it's very interesting for me. In the summertime, I'm in Canada. That's a time where I can do more competing for myself and not have regular students, but travel and do clinics. So the summertime is for clinics and my competing, and the judging happens all through the year, but I try not to let it take over my entire life, because as glamorous as it looks, the pay isn't amazing. It's considered to be a contribution to the sport, which I understand.
It'd be nice if the judges got paid. I know. You know, like, I don't know. I would think
we get paid, but
I mean, you know, but a little bit better. A little better.
Yeah. Like a CEO of a big corporation, when you get to the world championship level, maybe, but no, that doesn't happen. Yeah.
Wow. So now when somebody is you said you do clinics. Are clinics, are these group, or are they normally like, it's dressage, so it's one-on-one, but it's at a...
No, it's a great question. These are eventing clinics. So while a lot of my training in Ocala now is dressage, I don't know whether it's because I'm a good dressage teacher or whether everyone knows that I'm going to be judging them at some point. I'm not sure what it is, but no, the clinics are eventing clinics. We do flat work and gymnastics on the first day and cross country on the second day. If there's no cross country course, we'll do show jumping coursework on the second day. So, you know, quite honestly, all my dressage training goes into that first day, into the flat work, into trot poles, canter poles, position, balance, suppleness. You know, really, it's all the same. And when you go to Aachen, there was a 5-star CSI show jumping. When you go to Spruce Meadows or Wellington to watch the top show jumping, what's interesting is actually not only to watch the warm up for the jumping, but the warm up before the jumping. These top riders could be competing at FAI in dressage. Those horses are beautifully presented, beautifully balanced, very responsive to the aids. So it's all the same thing we're teaching.
Hmm. And you said like ride a test, like fix a test type of things. You do those? Is that?
Yes, more in the wintertime. Sarah runs a bunch of them. I do a couple on my own. But to try to teach people about this ring craft that you mentioned, people need to learn that.
Is that all in person, or do you like do? Can people send you video and do it remotely?
Darren, he's got great questions.
I know.
Is he trying to butter me up? Yeah.
During COVID.
Real quick, Peter, I am very self-conscious. Believe it or not, I ask these questions, but I am self-conscious when I ask them because I don't want them to be dumb questions. So
no, I think they're great questions. At least I think they're great questions, because during the 2 years of COVID, remember, I'm coming up to Canada. So it was 2 years, not 1 year in Florida, but actually 2 years of COVID. So I spent a lot of time in quarantine or isolated. And I started something called Centerline Workshop, where people sent in videos on YouTube for me to review. And what I did, I couldn't do it myself, so I got a 13-year-old girl to show me how to make an iMovie and do a voiceover. And so I charged $50 for this review of the test. It was fun for me to do during quarantine. It was fun for the riders at home to play around with their horse and ride a test and video it and send it in. I love anything to do with education. So I love doing those things.
Wow. Yes, Karen is very lucky.
Yes, I am.
She's the talker of the family. And I just,
as you could tell.
I put it on just for the show.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. That's fantastic.
Oh. All right. So, Peter, we are going to play quick fire questions.
Oh, my gosh. Okay.
And quick fire questions is brought to you by Turtleneck. Keep your horse dry when it rains with the rain turtle by going to turtleneck.biz. All right. So, five questions. First one.
Do I have to answer them as fast as I can?
No.
Okay. But we will grade you.
But you are graded. So
Ride IQ did something like this, and it was fantastic. It was 60 seconds, and they asked as many questions as they could in 60 seconds. And wow, I felt like I was on Jeopardy. Wasn't it?
You're welcome to, but it's
no.
Basically.
Yeah. It's just more fun.
But you're
okay.
Graded.
Here we go.
All right. So here we go. Favorite rider growing up?
Mark Todd.
Oh, that's a good one.
Mark Todd. He just has had all the sort of finesse that my trainer was trying to teach me. But I could see in that 6'5" body of his that I needed to try and do the same things in my 6'4" body. So yeah, I really looked up to him. Gotcha. And the other one would be Carl Hester as a dressage rider. And when I first met him in England, he was actually in his last year of eventing. So our world number one dressage rider, Carl Hester, actually was a former event rider. And honestly, I think that's why he's so successful, is because he trains his horses, like an eventer would. They ride lead, they go out in the paddock in groups of two or three. He does road work. He rides them like a horseman, like an eventer.
Very cool. That's
very good answers.
Good answers.
Good answers. All right. So what is one thing about yourself that most people don't know?
They don't know that I'm actually quite shy and not the outgoing person that maybe I put on that air when I'm teaching, when I'm judging. I speak with authority, but I'm actually quite a shy person.
Just like me.
Yeah.
What's so funny, you two?
I knew we had something in common.
I am an introvert. I push myself to be the person of the people. Scratch that, reverse that.
I'm also quite sensitive. I mean, you put a tearjerker movie on and it's embarrassing, but anyway.
What's your, what would be the one to really get you going? Do you have one off the top of your head that would get you going?
No.
He's not gonna say.
I know his. I know Rob's.
What's mine?
7 seconds.
8 seconds.
8 seconds.
Yeah. 8 seconds is a rodeo movie about Lane Frost.
He cried.
I cried. It's
yes, you did. You did. Mm.
But it's a rodeo movie, so it makes me very manly. It was a manly cry. There's a manly
cry. All right. So if eventing or dressage was not an option, what other riding discipline would you want to try?
Eventing. Or dressage. Probably show jumping. I was thinking endurance, no, that's not me. Driving, no. When I was in Bermuda, I told you my 35-year-old horse did all the classes, including ride and drive, and we had to rein back one day and we turned the carriage over. So that terrified me for life.
Oh, my goodness.
So, yeah, it would be show jumping.
All right.
Or just riding on the beach bareback.
Oh, that would be good. That sounds fun.
Speaking of which, kids don't ride bareback. They don't gallop around on the hills on their ponies. Everyone's in a ring. Anyway, yeah, third question.
All right. What is your one favorite thing about the sport of eventing?
First thing that comes to mind is the camaraderie, the people. We are all in it for everyone's success, not your own. And we hear this many times, people that maybe came from the show world and they did their first event and they come back and said, you know, on the way to the start box, I passed two people who I didn't even know. And they, one wished me good luck. The other one told me to watch the footing at fence four because it's a bit muddy. It really is a great community we have.
Yeah, that's nice. It sure is.
That's that. And that, besides the hello, besides the good luck, then say, hey, listen, watch out for that over there. You know, be safe. We want everyone to have a good, safe ride. And normally when that person's coming out of the ring while you're going in, you're in the same division. They're technically competing, you know?
Absolutely. Yep. Absolutely.
Yep. All right. So last question. If you could ride any horse, past, present, or fiction, who would it be?
I had a fascination with Lucinda Green's horse, Be Fair. It's a big chestnut. I had a couple of successful big chestnuts. And that one, maybe that's where I created a love for big chestnuts. That was a long time ago, but that was, and I was in awe with her riding and her successes and seven wins at Badminton and just incredible Olympic achievements. So yeah, that horse, I could see myself riding that one. The other one I could see myself riding, and again, this is years ago, was a horse that Mark Phillips rode that the Queen owned, Columbus. I love dapple gray horses. And this was a great big dapple gray. And so, yeah, those two come to mind. When I'm judging, I do often see one. There was a horse in Italy, I don't know his name, but I do think, oh, I could see myself on this one. I love this one. And the other judges are like, why were you 4 points higher on that? And I'm like, oh my God, that was the one I could see myself on.
That's fun. Well, but I think that goes back to what you said. You want the person to portray something that looks like enjoyable ride, you know, and there you go.
There you go.
Karen.
Well,
A+. Is
there another question?
No, that was it. That was five. That was five.
Because I thought of my biggest pet peeve.
Oh, what is it?
Oh, okay, let's hear it.
I can't even remember if it was, well, I'm judging or why, but people on the phone constantly when they're riding their horse.
Oh.
In fact, with some horses we've had in training, I would have to say to the working student, this is a no texting horse. In other words, this one might do a 180 at a moment's notice. It will be on the ground if you're not paying attention. But yeah, you know, for the small amount of time you're riding a horse, it's got to be about you and him, the relationship. Even if you're out trail riding, we're creating a bond. When you're schooling a horse, you can't be stopping every 5 minutes to check Facebook. So that makes me crazy.
Be present.
Yes.
Awesome. Karen.
Well, you got extra credit with that one.
Extra credit, A++. The crowd goes wild.
Oh, wow.
Listen to them. Oh, my God. They loved him.
We've got a big crowd tonight.
They love you. They're very well behaved. They love you. Excellent job.
Yeah.
Well done. Of course. Peter's a legend. He's a pro. He is.
So, Peter, do you have any advice for that rider, whether they an up-and-coming rider or an amateur trying to make it in this sport?
To remember that it is a sport. It's not, whatever happens to you is not going to change the ways of the world. It is a sport. to be considerate to your colleagues. And most importantly, it's about the horses. It's about being kind to your horse and being a partner with your horse and caring for that horse like he's the most important thing in the world. Unfortunately, some people are on a bit of a tangent, and it's just a way to get people some success or some notoriety. But that's what I love about eventing, is because it's, you can't be successful unless you do have that partnership with the horse. Mm-hmm. But the horse, I think the welfare of, and treatment of the horse would be really, it's got to be number one.
Yeah.
We were talking a little bit before we went like live, and you mentioned like, it sounds like you mostly owned your own horses, or you didn't have a lot of owners that would like push you and, you know, push the horses and so forth.
Yeah. You know, if I had to do this all over again, first of all, I wouldn't do biology and chemistry at university. I would learn about marketing and advertising and bookkeeping and accounting and computers, anything to help you move ahead and be as more successful in this, quite honestly, very difficult industry to have a viable, business these days. It's very, very difficult. And it's becoming more and more difficult as the cost of doing business with insurance and diesel gets higher and higher. So if I could do it all again, I would have changed what I learned. But then I get irritated with self-promotion that we see all the time on social media. I don't mind so much promoting yourself if you've got something to promote, but these people who are wannabes and they're self-promoting themselves as something they're not, it's all just fake news. That I find disturbing. But if you do have something to offer, and maybe I did at one point, I think if I had had the confidence and the skills in social media to market myself better, then that comes sponsors, that comes horse buyers. So to answer your original question, I never had many sponsors because A, I don't think I was good at recruiting them for the reasons I just mentioned. And second of all, I always like to be in charge of the destiny of my horse and the pathway we took at every competition that we went in, and not have external pressures from sponsors or followers that you might feel extra pressure to go extra fast in when the conditions weren't good, like I described earlier. I always took charge of I could make my own decisions, and I like that when there was a horse involved. So different things work for different people. I wish I could have had a string of top horses and, you know, eight horses like Philip had that day and me and my one. But honestly, I have no regrets. I've been a very lucky person. I've had great opportunities. I've met incredible people around the world through the sport of eventing. And some have more sponsors, some have less. But I did it my way and I enjoyed every minute of it.
Wow. Mm. You're still smiling,
Karen. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Do you ever get back to Bermuda, or have you been back there ever? Like,
good question. I'm going to Florida in the winter. Ticks the box of getting warm. But I do have family there. Paul and I are going down this Christmas. We go down probably every 3 or 4 or 5 years.
Gotcha. Beautiful. I want to go there. I want to cruise there one day.
Yeah.
My one brother has. He's the only one in the family that figured out how to make money. And he has nice boats and nice toys. And Paul's always saying, you know, it's really important to keep up with your family. We should go visit Jonathan. So.
the family with the money.
Yeah.
And the boats.
Yeah, and the boats. But we'll be going in December and enjoy some time on the ocean, which will be great.
Yeah, that'd be nice.
Very, very cool. Aww. I would like to get there someday. So
someday.
We don't want to hold you up any longer. I feel like I feel like because I glossed over so much, I hope that people listening understand. You know, we don't really don't like to keep our guests forever, but I could have talked to you forever. And I hope that I hope you enjoyed yourself.
Yeah, I kind of enjoyed this tonight. I actually tell people a lot about myself and my past and things that you found interesting. So anyway, that's unusual for me. But I hope your listeners are okay with it.
Well, I appreciate
it. I think it was great.
Yeah. You kind of had fun. Next time we'll make it definitely more fun. We will definitely.
No, honestly, you guys are fantastic. This is about the easiest interview I've ever done. It was lots of fun. And actually, I think it was really interesting having you're a lot more knowledgeable about the sport than you're letting on, but someone who's not a rider and a trainer and or a judge, I thought that the questions were really interesting. So,
well, thank you. That comes from Peter Drake.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much again.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully someday you get to come back on. People, go check out Ride IQ to learn more about these tests. You did a lot of work with the tests, and like you mentioned. And thank you again to those ladies. So,
yeah.
Karen, was this fantastic?
This was so much fun. Yeah. So,
thank you again, Peter.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And you can follow Peter on Instagram at psgray007. You can learn more at Ride IQ and Margaret Risen McKelvey's new book, Grid Pro Quo. And to contact Peter, email him at psgray007@hotmail.com.